and their innovative consulting and coaching division to bring solutions to the fastest growing audience in the country and the organizations that serve them. Recently, the Capinellis announced the formation of the World Council of Wisdom Keepers. Its founding members include Ram Dass, Angelus Aaron, Barbara Marks Hubbard, Dr. Gladys McCary, Reverend Michael Bernard Beckwith, Michael Mead, Jean Houston, and of course, George and Sedina Capinelli. Among the primary missions are making the world age-friendly, working with the United Nations to name a year of the elder, the Obama administration, and other governments to establish new departments of longevity, to establish elder councils in cities and towns, businesses, and institutions around the world. And that's the Capinellis on the phone right now. All right, I'm coming. Hello. What did I do here? Uh-oh. Hello? I hung up. Darn it. What did I do? Wait. Call me back. Caller on 543.
Hello? Please try again later.
Okay, call back. Let's try again. Let's see here. Turn this off. Okay. Come on, call back. 359-5483. Is it phone? Oh, I know. I haven't hung up. Okay, call back. I didn't hang up. I'm so sorry. I'm working through this. Do not go lightly. Do not go quietly. There you go. Here we go. Hello?
Hello?
Hi, George? Is this George? Hello? He can't hear me. How come I'm not hearing this? Hello? Let's see. Hello?
Yes.
Hi. Good. You know what? I'm trying to figure out how to do this. Oh, great. I got it. Do not go quietly.
Yeah.
And I'm not. I've really enjoyed reading this. I haven't read all 300 pages. I just got started a few days ago. But it is an excellent book. Absolutely excellent. Thank you for being here today, George. And Sedina, is she there too?
No, it's just George this morning.
All right, just George. All right. So I gave an introduction about this book that you and your wife has written, and it's a wonderful inspiration. It's a great motivator. So tell me, why did you write this book, George?
Well, the journey of this book began when both Sedina and I made late in life and end-of-life passages with both of our parents. It was clear to us during that process that we had not fully understood the condition of the health care system and the life care system in the United States, nor many of the serious challenges as well as the opportunities that faced older Americans. We had been blessed with good health and had really had very little exposure, truthfully, to that. And we were shocked, Eunice. You know, we were just shocked at how difficult America has made it to grow old. And so we decided we needed to do something about it. And out of that came the creation of a company called Age Nation that focuses on people in the second half of life, and Do Not Go Quietly is an important part of that new conversation.
So, George, how long did it take you both to write this book? Because it's very extensive. It covers quite a bit of the way we look at life as a whole, period. and how we've come to this interpretation of how what it means to be a human being. How long did it take you to write this?
Well, I could, without being facetious, say a lifetime. Mm-hmm. In that, you know, you accumulate information and understanding over the course of time. We've been actually and specifically working on this book for the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about some of your journey that has evolved that led to this experience that you said is a lifetime of this that's into this book. What has that journey been like? What have some of the things you've been involved in?
Well, Sedina and I have both individually and jointly spent the greatest part of our lives focused on supporting a change in our world, whether it's societal or organizational or individual. A lot of the things that each of us have done. I have been involved a lot in designing and delivering transformational seminars to people. I have been in the consulting world for 25 years, working with a lot of the major organizations in both the private and the public sector. Sedina began her career as an actress, communicating through theater and film and television roles and characters that she thought were inspiring and informative and uplifting to people. When we met and then married, she joined me in some of the consulting work, and she's also evolved her own work of, she does a lot of work on wellness, and she calls it enlivened aging and empowerment with women. I've had a film and television production company, and we did a lot of inspiring things for television in the early days of pay cable. And so our work is about assisting people, uplifting people, and learning ourselves. You know, we came to the conclusion quite early that life is like a large school. The truth of the matter is, although some of us like to pretend that we're not, we're always in class. I mean, every day is another opportunity to learn more of the lessons that we believe we came here to learn, and to grow in consciousness and awareness so that we can contribute more to the world around us. So those are some examples of some of the things we have done in our lives that contribute to where we are at the moment and some of the understandings we have.
Okay, well, sounds like you've had a very exciting, interesting life, and it's the foundation of has been your care. And I think that's one of the messages that I hear in your book too, that I understand coming through your book, is that no matter what stage we are in life, no matter what we are doing in life, there's a responsibility and there's a caring and a love and a accountability that goes along with that. So in this book, you say, "Do not go quietly for people who weren't born yesterday." You said subtitle. It says for people who were not born yesterday. Who do you include in this group?
Well, I mean, literally anybody who, you know, who's alive, you know, they weren't born yesterday, but, there's a particular group of Americans, older Gen Xers who are, 45 or 46, boomers who are 46 to 64, and then elders who are 65 plus. So that's really the core group for whom this book is addressed, but it's also written for younger people who want to know more about the world ahead, where the world is going, and better prepare for it, because truly they're the ones that are inheriting both the challenges and the opportunities. And we use the term for people who weren't born yesterday because some people like or don't like the term boomer or senior or elder or Gen Xer or whatever. So we looked for a phrase that had a touch of humor to it and would be inclusive of all of us.
Interesting that you said, too, people who are in their 30s could benefit from reading this book. You know, we don't want to be old anymore in this country. Nowhere do we want to be old. It says you talk about a demographic revolution. What is it and why should we pay attention to it? So what is this demographic revolution that's going on?
Well, the age of our population here in the United States and in almost all of the other industrial countries of the world, that demographic population is shifting. There's what's called a graying of our population. And eventually, over the next several decades, some say as many as 50% of the population here in the United States and in all of the other industrialized countries will be 50 years of age or older for the first time in history. So that 50% of our population number is pretty staggering if we stop to consider it and its implications, social, cultural, political, economic, ecological, are astounding. It's one of the most significant challenges and opportunities we as a people face. And this shifting, this demographic revolution, will actually go on for the first 65 to 70 years of this century. So it's not a small short-term shift. It's a major shift of extraordinary proportions that will affect all of our lives, even those of us who are not 50 and over.
All right. Here's another question for you. You say our government and many of our institutions and businesses and most of us individuals are not prepared for either the challenges and the opportunities that lie ahead. Why do you think this is so, and why isn't the media talking about it? Because what we're hearing is more of a aversion to being older, but yet this population is definitely here, and this is going to be around for a while, correct? So
yes.
How are we unprepared? What are the challenges?
Well, we have become a nation that is youth-obsessed and age-adverse. Now, there's nothing wrong with being young. I mean, it's an extraordinary time of life filled with new opportunities and vitality and desire to do and engage and all the rest of it. But somehow or another, America has lost track of the fact that there's more than one or two acts to life. There's also a third act. And if you think about plays, if you think about books or music or dance or anything, there's always novels, there's always a concluding act where the story of captured in the music or the dance or the characters in a novel, it comes to a summation where the ends are tied off and it makes sense, and the lessons that are inherent in that creative experience are made more apparent. Well, life is like that too, but for some reason or another, largely I think because we're still living under the outmoded values that were created in the 19th century with the Industrial Revolution. It became all about productivity and performance and profitability and economics. And somewhere along the way, we lost sight of the fact that life has a lot of other purposes except making money or acquiring material objects, that life has a deeper purpose, a deeper meaning. And because of that tributary that we took, what was most important was how much work could you do, how many productive hours could you spend. And we lost sight of the value of experience and wisdom and an understanding of historical perspective, that all of the indigenous peoples and most of the successful societies in history did not forget about. So age-obsessed, age-averse, youth-obsessed, as a result, we have this cliche that's been formed in a lot of people's minds and an aversion to aging. And yet aging is a natural stage. It's an extraordinary thing. I mean, yes, it has its limitations. Yes, you know, our body isn't quite the way it used to be, and we can't do all of the things we could do when we were 14. But the fact of the matter is there are some extraordinary things that we can do in this stage of life, and those things are being undervalued and set aside. We also have a lot of people in government, especially, who I would refer to as a little wet behind the ears, you know. They haven't had a whole lot of experience in some ways. And yet, and they're also focused so obsessively on this bogus conversation about budget reduction, you know. And they forget that life is both about investment as well as fiscal responsibility. So they're treating age as if aging was an accident that should be corrected. It should be removed from the balance sheet, you know. So do not go quietly. And all of the work that Sedina and I do is to help wake people up and remind them that aging is natural, dying is natural. It's you get a ticket into a theater and eventually you exit it, and that's part of this process. And the more we are aware of it, the more we incorporate it into our lives, it makes our lives richer. It makes our time more consequential because it isn't limitless. It isn't endless in its scope. So we live in a society that avoids aging, obsesses about youth, denies reality, and is today attempting to create a whole series of policies and systems that ultimately will make aging more and more difficult. We've lost our compassion. We've lost our understanding, and we need to get it back.
Mm-hmm. I agree so fully with that. Listeners, we are, this is WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, and this is Higher Ground, and I am Eunice Buckner Boone on the telephone line with George Capanelli. Is that how you say you pronounce your name?
Yes.
I'm glad I got
George
it right.
Capanelli.
Author, co-author with his wife Sedina of this book called Do Not Go Quietly. I think it's a awesome book. Do Not Go Quietly, A Guide to Living Consciously and Aging Wisely to People Who Weren't Born Yesterday. And getting back to that point about how we look at aging and the natural process of aging. So is that why you created, you know, and how it's our version to it has actually, you know, influenced a lot of things, a lot of decisions we make, the way we run business, the way we see ourselves, the way we include ourselves as seniors, as older persons in this. Is that why you created the organization, Age Nation?
Absolutely. You know, and the thing, Eunice, is that it's not as if this story that America has bought into about aging is true. It's a lie.
Mm-hmm.
The truth of the matter is there are tremendous numbers of people, many of whom are revered by our society, who did not accomplish their greatest accomplishment until they were 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the George Burns, the famous humorist and comedian, once said, old, young, just words, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, he was close to 100 and about to give his, a performance when he passed away.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many people that we look to in our world and celebrate, who did just remarkable things. I mean, today, one of the world's great actresses, you know, Dame Judi Dench, in her 70s, are a number of other major characters. The oldest woman in the world died not very long ago. She lived to be 122 years and 164 days.
Mm-hmm.
At 100, she was a French woman by the name of Calmont. And at 100, she was still riding her bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
It just goes on and on and on and on. Geronimo wrote an autobiography at 77.
Michelangelo was still doing...
Yes, he was still working on the on St. Peter's in his 80s. William de Kooning, one of the great painters of the 20th century, produced some of his best work in his 80s.
Mm-hmm.
William Shatner, you know, people know him from Star Trek and Boston Legal and all of these shows. He's in his 80s, and he's still acting and showing horses and doing all kinds of things. So it doesn't matter what the field is. You know, Pablo Casals, probably the greatest cellist in the history of the world, gave his last performance at 93.
Mm.
So there's a myth that the world is living by that just isn't true. So we've marginalized and tend to ostracize people who are older. And so it's no wonder that some of us who are older say, well, gee, I don't want that kind of a life. And yet that's not the life we need to lead.
And plus it's not true, as you said it.
Yes, it's a lie.
Mm-hmm.
It is a lie.
Because I was thinking about another person, because throughout your book you have this life rule, life achievement, life tool at the end of each section, which I think is so powerful. And you actually mention people about what they're doing as older people. And we do. We revere people who are still doing great things, but we have this sort of divide, mental divide, as to, okay, on one hand, we like it, but on the other hand, I don't want to be old. You know, it's very interesting. One other thing I want to ask you, you gave me some really wonderful questions to ask you, is you say in here, you encourage the reader to live the life they were born to live. How do people know what this life is? So even as an adult, older person, they should reflect on the life they're living. Explain some more of that.
Well, Sedina and I are amongst those that believe that each of us comes into the world with something to do, you know, something that we have come here to do. In many indigenous societies, the shaman or elders in the community, when a child is born, one of the things that they do is they try to understand what the gift is that that child has brought to their tribe or their community. And those gifts are encouraged. And so that's, Sedina and I believe that each of us comes in with that thing to do that is uniquely ours that no one else can do in quite the way we do. It's kind of like the note or the instrument we play or can play in the great song that is life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we go back to that thing we talked about the values of the Industrial Revolution, in some ways, those values corrupted life because the individual gifts that people have are not important in a consumer-driven society where products and services are the reason for its existence.
Mm-hmm.
So people have to be homogenized. They have to be educated to conform. And so in our schools and whatnot tend largely not to foster what is unique and creative in each human being. Instead, what they tend to foster is how to pay attention, how to be a good student, how to be quiet, how to mimic the information that teachers give. And the better the mimic the child is, the higher the grade. So that unique note is sometimes and oftentimes set aside. We're encouraged by voices that care about us, mm-hmm. but have had their own limiting experience, to set aside those foolish dreams. You know, as children, we want to be astronauts or firemen or writers or doctors or painters or, you know, and what we're often encouraged to do is put those things aside, get straight, get practical, figure out some way to earn a living, put aside some money, get into the line of employment and all the rest of it. Now, that's necessary. I mean, we have to pay our way on the physical planet. But along the way, many of us set aside those dreams that we came here. And yet, when we're honest, when we get quiet, when we have things that interrupt our lives, we tend to hear a little bit more. We tend to go back to wondering what would have happened if. Mm-hmm. So what Do Not Go Quietly is about, what it encourages, is for people to remember what those original dreams are. Mm. So that we say that it's never too late or never too soon to live our dreams. Because those dreams, have within them the blueprint for an incredible life, one of greater commitment, engagement, passion, energy, and generally much greater success than the life that we sometimes choose or feel that we have to choose that keeps us between the lines,
mm-hmm. That's
and
so powerful.
Prevents us from living the life we were born to live.
So you talk about some tools that help us to get in touch with ourselves.
Yes.
What are some of those tools?
Well, first, I think admitting or being willing to admit that there is a dream. And sometimes we don't even know what it is. Sometimes it's just a kind of restlessness. We know that what we are doing is not enough. We're not quite sure what it is that we could do or should do. And again, as I said, some of the things that are the hints or clues we set aside because somebody said you can't carry a tune in a bucket, or that doesn't look like a horse you just drew, or it's foolish to dream of being this or that. You come from a level of society or a community or whatnot that doesn't allow that, you know? So our first step is to admit that we have a dream.
Admit
our second step is to begin to explore what that dream is. And the best way of doing that is to find some time just to get quiet with oneself, you know, to be someplace where we're not interrupted, to sit and to ask inside of ourselves, what am I here for? You know, who am I? What am I supposed to do truly in this life? One doesn't have to immediately jump off of a cliff. Mm-hmm. Just make a few notes or begin to get comfortable again with those thoughts, with that understanding. Because the greatest wisdom that any of us possess comes from inside of us. Mm-hmm. Not from outside of us. I mean, we can listen to the noise of the world from now until the cows come home. And in our world, there's certainly a lot of noise. So who do you trust? Who do you believe? Who do you follow? What do you listen to? Well, our advice is listen to yourself. Because each of us has more wisdom, more authentic, original, unique wisdom than we're ever going to find in the world around us. Mm. So admit that there's a dream. Begin to ask questions of who am I? What am I doing here? What am I supposed to do? Find time to be quiet. Be willing to listen to what's called that still small voice within. be willing to trust the hints and the suggestions. Maybe we get an impulse suddenly to blow some dust off those paintbrushes that are over in the corner, or to open the cover of the piano or our toolbox, or to find those notebooks where we've got some drawings for inventions or projects or businesses or plays or novels or something, you know? And little by little, if we trust and we take some steps and we start to do some of the things that we're encouraged to do from within, then we can find a way to start gaining some momentum. And it doesn't mean we have to throw away the rest of our lives or quit our jobs or any of those things. But we can also start bringing some of that renewed passion and creativity and self-respect and joy that we get from doing the things that we love back into our world, into our lives with our families and our children and our friends and our co-workers. And then maybe there will come a time where we can make a transition from doing something that is really someone else's work or someone else's thing, and we can start to make a transition into doing our thing, the thing we were born to do. And we will then find a way, if we trust, if we listen, and if we are willing, courageous enough, to take some of these preliminary steps, then we believe, and our experience is, that life opens in some very unique ways.
That's powerful. It makes me think about the example you gave, because you have many examples of people, actual people, who have come to this understanding about what their true self is in their 80s. And I think it was Unsinkable Molly.
Yes.
Would you tell us more about her?
Well, sure. A number of years ago, when I was doing those large seminars, transformational seminars and conferences, I did a program for social and political activists. And on the first day, this remarkable woman from Cleveland, whose name was Molly Brown, was part of a group of social workers and activists who had driven all night from Cleveland in a van to be in Philadelphia for the start of this program. I was impressed with her from the beginning. You know, she had a lot of energy and creativity, but she was also carrying a lot of sadness. And during the course of the time we spent in this program that I was facilitating, I came to understand that some of the sadness was the result of her own aging process, and also the sadness that she felt when she looked out around her community and saw that there were not enough programs or services for the aging members of her community. But she did some great work, and she came to some terrific understandings by doing some of the things that I just talked about. You know, being willing to admit that she had a dream, getting quiet and beginning to listen to her guidance. And several months after the seminar concluded, I opened my mail one morning, and there was a large vanilla envelope in the mail, and when I opened it, it was a copy of the front page of the Cleveland newspaper, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and there was Molly standing on the steps of City Hall with a group of people, her arms raised and a great smile on her face. She was taking part in a demonstration, and Molly was in her 80s at that time, and so she is a symbol for me, an inspiration that helps me to remember that I can do great things if I stay in touch with my heart and if I follow my dream.
And there's a technique that you wrote about in your book too, about something about bringing yourself out of a kind of stagnant place. It just came to me when I thought of Molly's hands raised up, as opposed to gradually releasing. Oh, I know what it was. It was about the fists, holding your hand.
Oh, yeah. Yes, yes. It's a, you know, it's an exercise. It's because it's experiential. You know, you learn by doing it more than anything else. And so, and it takes a few minutes to do, but there's a way that we can learn from holding our fists tightly closed for a period of time, really squeezing them, and then releasing them. We can learn that a lot of times in life, what we hold on tightly to things, and we hold on to them because we're afraid that if we don't hold on to them, we're going to experience some kind of pain or severe discomfort. But in reality, the quicker we let go, the more we let go all at once, we move through that discomfort quickly, and we find that all of the anticipation and projection about what would happen or the pain, that's oftentimes so much greater than the letting go. The letting go is instantaneous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in some ways, Eunice, that's the fear that many people have about the end of life. You know, they have this terrible fear that life is going to end in great pain and suffering and all the rest of it. And yet, you know, our world today is filled with stories of people who have had near-death experiences or whatever, and recognize that the letting go is often a beautiful thing, and so much easier than we anticipate, and that life doesn't end. You know, the energy of living goes on, whether it's in one form or another. And some of the greatest teachers and wise beings in history have told us the same thing. Many of the world's great religions are founded on the premise of an afterlife, of an experience beyond physical form. So letting go of the burdens we're carrying, of the beliefs that we hold that limit us, of all of these things, it's such an extraordinary opportunity, and it's available every single day.
And that exercise is so interesting because in the book you describe it as holding your fists for, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 minutes, a long time where you're actually feeling the pain of holding your fists, the nails digging into your hand, your palm of your hand. And then there's a way in which we think, okay, well, we've got all this that we've been carrying around, and this is the way I've been doing it, this is the way I've been living, and you're in this painful place of living, or really not really living, and you're in pain, and you think you have to gradually let it go. And this one is that it's the difference between gradually letting it go and letting it go immediately. So
yes,
it's a consciousness of, I'm not going to continue to process any more of this, but I'm going to let it go and open myself up right now in this moment for something new to come in.
And, you know, it's one of the things about that exercise that people learn is that it's really hard to be available, to be able to
mm-hmm.
take up something new when your hands are so closed and clenched, holding on to whatever you think you have or whatever you think you need. But when one's hands are open, then almost anything can come into them, you know.
Mm-hmm. Wow, it's so much here, so much. This book is absolutely fabulous, absolutely. I haven't read it all, but it is absolutely, I'm going to read it. Every bit of
good.
It. I'm going to do the exercises. That's the other thing that I think is really good about this book, is that you actually have exercises that you can do after you read, taking in some insights, some information, and then you say, okay, now why don't you just stop and just journal, write, allow yourself to experience it. And I think it's so awesome to encourage us to not just rely on information that's coming into us, but relying on our own information. How are we going to bridge this gap between what is youth and what is aging in our society? How do we begin to cultivate that. Is that something that you address when you talk about exploring the topic of legacy and stewardship?
Yes. Some of it happens naturally. For an example, today there is an affinity that exists between those younger people that are called the millennials and those people who are the older Gen Xers, boomers, and elders. The folks in the middle, the other Gen Xers, and they have a different set of values, but younger people are much more committed again to the well-being of society. They don't have a lot of the prejudices and biases that limit other generations. Our generations, the boomers and elders, played such a major role in a lot of the social movements of the last century and the social change, human rights, civil rights, women's rights, animal rights, anti-nuclear, environmental movements, on and on and on. Many of us were deeply committed to making the world a better place. Now, we also made a number of mistakes, clearly, and part of the challenge we issue in Do Not Go Quietly is we invite people to use the time they have remaining, whether it's decades or days, to make right their relationship with themselves and the world around them. So we have some making up to do. But we also have a great affinity with younger people, and they have a great affinity with us. And so there's a naturalness that's possible. But there's also, we believe, a responsibility that those of us who are older have, and that is to reach out to younger people and to get to know them, to take some time to share with them, not to tell them what to do, not to try to enforce our values because we think we know it all, but to begin a real dialogue in which we learn, again, from their innocence and their enthusiasm, and they learn from us, from our mistakes as well as our victories. So that's something we can do with our own children, our own grandchildren, with people in our communities. And we have that ability every day, but we have to be honest, you know. We can't just tell the success stories of, you know, how good we were and how important we were and how we know how everything works. We have to be truthful. We have to speak from our heart. We have to let people know through our experience we can allow others to glimpse through the window of our time some of both the challenges and the opportunities of life. So we have such a responsibility to leave the world better than the world that we inherited. And unfortunately, in our case, that's not yet the case. So we also have choices we can make about, this last economic time has had a significant impact on a lot of us who are older. But, you know, we still have things of value that we can leave, tangible as well as intangible. And a question we should be asking ourselves is, how do we use those things? Yes, we can leave whatever we have to our children or whatever, but we can also contribute some of that to organizations and institutions that really need support. It's said that boomers and elders are going to oversee the largest transfer of wealth in the history of the world over the next several decades. And the question is, are we going to do it the way it's always been done, or are we going to find some unique ways to give back to society as well as to our family?
Awesome, awesome. You know, you have a very interesting chapter, and we've got to deal with some of that, and that is so important. You touched upon some of that, and when you talked about death, it says, celebrating, the chapter title is Celebrating Life, Befriending Death. What does that mean? So how do we befriend death? It's so important. It's almost we don't talk about it. We just sort of deal with it. Is it an intrusion?
Well, first of all, we begin the journey, I think, by admitting to ourselves that there is an exit to life. We call it death, you know, but there are also different ways of reframing it. Very few of us are adverse to taking vacations or holidays. And what if death isn't some terrible end or conclusion? What if death is a holiday from some of the burdens and challenges and opportunities of physical life? You know, what if it's a chance to refresh and renew? And I think we have less concern about death the more we pay attention to life and to the quality of life that we're leading. I think that if we are living the life we were born to live, we recognize that we're not going to live forever. So we do the things that we need to do. We learn the lessons. We build the gifts and share them. And then we move on. We graduate to another part of the dance, another process. So first it's admitting that it exists. Second, it's
so how do you do that? So hold on a second. So admitting that it exists. So, okay, how do I do that? Say, what do I say, George? Death exists?
Well, yes, in some ways. And I look around and I don't look and get frightened by all of the crazy media stories that focus on the worst forms of ending anybody could have. Mm-hmm. But I look around and I remember maybe there was a grandmother or a grandfather who passed away who was actually living in our home or was close to us. Maybe we had an experience of that. But we recognize that the dying, just like, you know, we celebrate births, we celebrate marriages, we celebrate graduations and new jobs and all the rest of it. If we would just say to ourselves, I'm going to reframe my belief, I'm going to recognize that I can celebrate my death as well. Mm-hmm. The best way to do that is to live a good life, to be loving, to be compassionate, to be caring, to do the things that my heart tells me I'm supposed to do in my life, to offer forgiveness to myself and to others, and to live my dream. And if I do those things, then death is just another step in the dance.
Mm-hmm.
So first, accept it. Yes. Mm-hmm. Is it hard to accept? Yes. Sometimes. When we say befriend it, there's an old writer by the name of Carlos Castaneda who wrote a series of books about mentorship and the journey of life. And he used to advise people to literally learn to consult with death. Keep death, he used to say, over your left shoulder and turn to it and use it as a way of understanding that we don't have an unlimited number of moments. That this moment is a precious one. How do I use it?
Mm-hmm.
Could I be doing something different with this person? Could I speak more honestly? Could I support them in some way? Mm-hmm. And if we do each moment better, knowing that it's not, we don't have an infinite number of them, then we cease to have this experience. The death is some terrible end. It's going to deny us or cut us short. And it has enormous consequences in so many ways, not only for us as spiritual beings that are making a physical journey, but literally on the economics of our time. Do you know that we spend as a nation over $500 billion annually on medical procedures that are performed in the last stages of someone's life that are completely unnecessary and have no ability to truly prolong life.
Mm-hmm.
And we do that because we are a society that denies death.
Mm.
Instead of preparing for it, mm-hmm. instead of making the passage of the people we love more comfortable and more sacred mm-hmm. and giving them the support that they need, we drug them up, we hook them up to machines, we give them hip replacements and a host of things. The average American spends between 80 and 90% of the money they spend on health care during their entire life in the last year of their life.
Mm.
And all of that is because doctors and hospitals and people in general don't know how to talk about death, how to counsel about death, or how to experience death.
Mm-hmm.
So we cling tenaciously to the last stages of our lives, even if we have outlived what it is that we came here to do.
Mm-hmm. All right.
If we surrender,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you read the stories that are written by hospice workers and family members who participate in end-of-life experiences, they talk about what a blessed, sacred, extraordinary thing it is
mm-hmm.
when people are ready and they surrender.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're on ventilators and drugs and all the rest of it, how can they do that?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Totally a different experience. It's a total different thought. It's almost freeing. Absolutely.
I mean, it's like, you know, it's like in some ways walking out of the door of your house,
mm-hmm.
you know, one minute you're in this house, you might like it, you might not like it, and the next minute you're out in the fresh air. And it's no more complicated than that, except that we've made it so much more complicated.
Wow. And that there's an exercise where you actually have like,
Castaneda.
Yes, and where you're actually talking to death, your death, right?
Yes.
You're having this conversation, and I couldn't understand it when it said live each day as if you're going, tomorrow you might die or you might die. How do you do that? I couldn't understand that until I read that in the book about actually having a conversation with it. It's so important, you know, that you understand how do you make that connection? How do you do that thing that they say? You know, being in the moment, accepting, you know, being present, being in the now, you know, living your life authentically. You have so many good examples and stories and all this information is in. It's not just information. It's really a very compassionate book, a very loving book. But it helps you to see yourself in so as an entire being, you know, not just one aspect of who you are and not just one way of looking at yourself and looking at life, but it's a broadening. It's this widening out of yourself. This is an excellent, excellent, excellent book. So you said one thing is to admit we die. Then what were the other things you said too?
Well,
I didn't want to interrupt
you
further.
We have to befriend it. We have
befriend
to accept it?
It
within ourselves.
Okay.
We have to allow it to help us live a quality life,
mm-hmm.
And to become a more quality being.
That's
where
right.
Where we practice greater excellence, greater compassion, greater loving, greater mm-hmm. understanding, greater forgiveness,
mm-hmm.
and greater commitment to the things that we've come here to do.
That's, yes. Elaborate on that. We came here to do something.
Yes. And, you know, because we live with these false beliefs and myths that we can, but we think about it. I mean, we've had friends at each stage of our lives that have passed on. It's not as though the only time you pass on is when you're old, you know. We've had young people that we know that have passed on. We have coworkers, you know, and it's okay to say, oh, God, it was so terrible. We lost so-and-so and all the rest of it. In some ways, that's the unfinished life in us speaking.
Mm.
That's the part in us that knows that we still have things to learn that are unlearned, that we may be resisting.
Mm-hmm.
That's the part in us that hasn't yet forgiven enough, that hasn't accepted enough, that hasn't committed enough. And so we feel this sense of regret, you know. Poor Harry, poor Mary, poor whomever, their life was cut short. Well, what if that was the life that they were designed to live? Even if they were a young child who passed on, maybe that's the only bite of life they needed. Or maybe they came to share one gift or one set of gifts. And having done that, their journey was complete. At the same time, I think there are a lot of us, even if we have a short journey, that we don't do what we came here to do. And so there is that regret. There is that closed fist, that clinging tenaciously to something. But we have a different choice. We have an opportunity, and what Do Not Go Quietly is all about is all of those little tips and tools and thoughts and inspiring stories and quotes and examples that we can use every day to help us remember, because that's what it's all about. It's about remembering that moment-by-moment stuff that you were talking about, that living in the now, is just about being conscious so that we make a choice that is higher and better for us and other people in this moment, rather than a choice that is lower.
Wow, powerful.
And that leads to sadness or confusion or doubt or anger or any of the things we're all susceptible to. And we're all here to learn how to do better.
Ooh, awesome. Last question. If you had some closing advice for people who weren't born yesterday, what would it be?
Remember how precious life is. Remember that you don't have any full understanding of how many moments of preciousness that you have. Be incredibly grateful for whatever you have. Even if you think it's lousy or terrible, it is a gift that is giving you an opportunity to learn things. Use these moments to wake up. There are so many great teachers and guides that are on this planet to help us remember. And above all, trust the wisdom that flows through yourself far more than you trust anything happening around you. Because there's a difference between believing and knowing. And most of the world operates on other people's beliefs. But when you know something, you know how to ride a bike, you know how to fix something, you know how to do something, that is so real and so indisputable. And there's that knowledge that exists inside of yourself, how to live your life. And if you're willing, even against the advice of others, even if it costs you somebody's approval or somebody's acknowledgement, life isn't about being liked, it's about being lived. And if we follow the wisdom of our hearts, we have the greatest possibility of living the life we were born to live.
I love you.
I love you too, Eunice.
Thank you. Oh, my goodness. Could you read the last thing? We're going to say goodbye. And I would love to have a copy, autographed copy of your book if you'd like to give it to me. My husband copied 300 pages on our printer, but I would love an autographed copy. I'm just putting my plug in now.
We'll be absolutely certain that you get one.
Oh, thank you. Okay, could you read Not Quietly what you wrote? That one, Not Quietly, by the author. And then we're going to close with that. And I'll write
you an
email. Yes.
People can get this book, at their local bookstores or on Amazon.com or any of those places.
Do not go quietly.
We will not go quietly, not meekly into this or any other night. We who cheered when Martin walked and who first heard Rachel Carson's call, we who lost our heroes to hate and tried to find ourselves in love, we who died at Kent State and cheered when the wall came down, we who contributed to the loss of America's grace and then celebrated the rebirth of hope, we will not go quietly, not meekly, into this or any other night. We will harvest our experience and bay at the moon of new possibility. We will dance to life's mysteries